Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 25th of September, these are our main stories. Police in Kosovo kill three gunmen to end a standoff at a monastery. A space capsule, which could shed light on how planets will form, lands in the US.
Touchdown of the OSIRIS-REx sample return capsule. A journey of a billion miles to asteroid Bennu and back has come to an end.
And hundreds of ethnic Armenians leave the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Also in this podcast, pornographic images of real Spanish teenagers created by artificial intelligence.
She said, "Mom, there are photos of me circulating, of my naked torso. These are fake photos of girls that are being created a lot right now."
And the Thai elephants and their handlers who've ditched performing for tourists in exchange for a more peaceful lifestyle. Start in Kosovo, where a standoff between police and heavily armed gunmen in a Serbian Orthodox monastery after they killed a policeman has now come to an end. The incident took place in a town in the north, which is mainly Serb. The police eventually seized control of the monastery. Three of the gunmen were killed, two were arrested, and large numbers of weapons were seized. I found out more from our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay.
The situation is now reported to be calm. The religious authorities at the monastery are saying that the armed persons who broke through the monastery gate have left, and currently they have both Kosovo police and also ULEX, which is the EU's rule of law mission in Kosovo, inside the monastery. So that's what the monastery itself is saying. In terms of what's coming out of the authorities in Kosovo, the Prime Minister Albin Kurti is now saying that they've arrested six people in connection with these incidents, the shooting and the killing of the police officer, as well as the sporadic shooting throughout the day. There have been three people involved in this armed group who've been killed, and now the process of questioning these people will start to find out exactly who they are and what their motivations were.
Now, obviously, tensions were pretty high in the region before all of this. This can only inflame them. What happens next, do you think?
Well, it's really a very tricky situation indeed. This is the most serious incident that we've seen in Kosovo for some time. And any incident like this has the potential to escalate and become extremely serious. So if this really has now ended with arrests or the dispersal of this armed group and there's no further shooting, that can only be a good thing. What's going to happen next, of course, is working out who actually is responsible for all this. Serbian officials have already said the Kosovo's been far too quick to point the blame at Serbia. Prime Minister Kurti accusing Belgrade of funding this armed group. Serbia saying, well, how can you possibly know this when you haven't arrested or questioned them yet? So all of that has to be sorted out. And the European Union wants to bring everybody back around the negotiating table to try to de-escalate the tensions.
Well, the leaders of Kosovo and Serbia have been trading accusations against each other over this. Before the siege had ended, Kosovo's Prime Minister Albin Kurti, who's from Kosovo's ethnic Albanian majority, said Serbia was behind the attack.
We condemn this criminal and terrorist attack, organised crime with political, financial and logistical support from Belgrade is attacking our country. The criminals and those who give them orders will fail. They will be caught, tried and punished.
The Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, responded by blaming Prime Minister Kurti for continuing to provoke the local Serb population.
He left people alone to worry about their future, and all the time he kept provoking them. I regret that some Serbs succumbed to those provocations. Albin Kurti is the only one to blame. Albin Kurti is the only one who wants conflict and war. His life's desire is to drag us into war with NATO. That's the only thing he wants.
Next to Nagorno-Karabakh, an area so badly damaged by fighting that people who live there say they have nowhere to bury their dead. Now, over 1,000 ethnic Armenian refugees have reportedly arrived in Armenia after fleeing the disputed territory that was captured by Azerbaijani forces 6 days ago. The area has been largely controlled by ethnic Armenians for 30 years, even though it's been internationally recognised as part of Azerbaijan. The Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, who's faced calls to resign in daily protests, said he believed the number of ethnic Armenians leaving the region would now grow.
Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh continue to face the threat of ethnic cleansing. And unless real living conditions are created for the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh and there are effective mechanisms of protection from ethnic cleansing, then the likelihood that the Armenians will see exile from their homeland as the only way to preserve their lives increases significantly.
Ethnic Armenian separatist fighters in Nagorno-Karabakh have now agreed to put down their weapons. In Azerbaijan's capital Baku for us, here's Olga Ivshina.
We got back from Shusha, which Azeri authorities consider the capital of Karabakh. We were among the very first journalists which were allowed in since the start of the September hostilities. However, this was a tightly controlled trip. So we were escorted into Shusha and shown a large display of weapons, including tanks, APCs, automatic guns, RPGs, huge amount of weapons, all laid down by Karabakh Armenians in the recent 48 hours. This was one of the prerequisites of the ceasefire. The situation in Karabakh, however, remains tense. Azeri authorities are saying they are ready to provide security guarantees for all civilians in the region and they will only target armed rebels. However, Karabakh Armenians who are trapped in Stepanakert are very worried about their security. It's a humanitarian crisis on the ground. People say the food, water and medical supplies are lacking. There is no electricity. We were able to see it with our own eyes because Shusha is overlooking Stepanakert. So as soon as it became dark, Stepanakert was pitch black, which was a stark contrast with the brightly lit streets of Shusha. Azerbaijan says it has established a few refugee camps and is ready to allocate refugees. However, Karabakh Armenians are highly suspicious. This decades-long conflict has seen a lot of bloodshed. Both sides are accusing each other of war crimes, and there is a lot of mistrust on both sides, which doesn't help the process. Despite all the statements, all the diplomatic agreements and calls to action, it's clear that destiny of Karabakh Armenians is currently in Azeri hands.
Olga Evshina in Baku. A capsule carrying dust and rock from an asteroid which has been travelling through the solar system for billions of years has landed safely back on Earth.
Touchdown. I repeat, DDL. FRC has touchdown.
And touchdown of the OSIRIS-REx sample return capsule. A journey of a billion miles to asteroid Bennu and back has come to an end, opening a time capsule to our ancient solar system.
The craft touched down in a desert in Utah at 8:52 local time, marking the end of NASA's seven-year mission and the beginning of years of study of its precious cargo. The samples could answer fundamental questions about the origins of our planet and how life upon it began. There's also a chance the asteroid, Bennu, could collide with the Earth one day in the future. So how serious is that threat in Utah for us? Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
It's a possibility, an outside possibility, I should say. But it's useful to understand what these objects are made of, how they're put together, because if you do want to use some sort of defence strategy, maybe you want to deflect it slightly so that when it intersects with Earth orbit, it either just goes in front of it or just behind it. And knowing what it's made about will tell you something about the sort of thing you might do to move it, smash something into it. But that's one reason why we might want to study asteroid Bennu.
OK, now, every fact about this whole mission, about how far away Bennu is, how long it's taken the spacecraft to get there and back, is mind-blowing, as is the idea that the cargo that's just landed in the desert where you are could explain all sorts that we don't already know about how life on Earth began.
If you want to understand the history of planet Earth, it's quite difficult on planet Earth itself, because the rocks here constantly recycle, plate tectonics, weathering. So if you pick up a rock and you look at it, it's actually not a very old rock, okay? You want rock that is original, stuff from 4.5 billion years ago when the sun was forming and the planets were forming around it. And asteroids like Bennu, we think, are the leftover building blocks, if you like. And therefore, the chemistry in an asteroid like Bennu probably preserves the chemistry that existed 4.5 billion years ago. So they'll look into that. They want to see things like the amount of water that the rock holds. This beautiful Earth of ours is covered in 70% water, the oceans. Where did that water come from? When we consider how Earth started, it would have been this hot boiling rock. It would have evaporated all of its water. But it is here now. And the other fascinating thing is the carbon chemistry. How did life get started? We're based on carbon. Is there carbon compounds in this asteroid that can tell us about the origin of life?
Jonathan Amos with some big questions for us in Utah. A small town in southern Spain has been rocked by a case involving fake nude photographs of young girls, which have been generated by artificial intelligence. More than 20 girls have been the victims of the fakes, which raise questions about the use of AI. From southern Spain, here's Guy Hedgeco.
Almendralejo is a sleepy town on the plains of Extremadura. But in recent days, the rest of Spain has been watching it closely, as many of its families have had their worlds turned upside down.
Artificial y que ayer nos llegaba desde Extremadura. Hay siete menores identificados ya por la policía. Cogían fotografías de niñas.
Nude images of girls from the town, aged between 11 and 16, have been circulating on social media. But the pictures are not real. They were created using photos of the same girls fully clothed, often taken from their own social media accounts. These were then fed into an AI application, which provided imagined images of the girls, either partly or fully unclothed. Maria Blanco Rayo is the mother of a 14-year-old girl who was targeted.
One day my daughter came out of school. She got in the car and I asked her what was the matter. She said, "Mom, there are photos of me circulating, of my naked torso." I asked her if she had taken any photos of herself nude, and she said, "No, Mom, these are fake photos of girls that are being created a lot right now, and there are other girls in my class that this has happened to as well."
A total of 28 girls have come forward so far, complaining that fake nude pictures of them have been posted on social media.
I felt impotent. I asked myself, how could this happen? You don't imagine this kind of thing. There are some girls who are in a very bad way. There are girls who won't even leave their house.
The police are investigating at least 10 boys, aged 12 to 14, who have been identified as being involved. The case came to light in great part because of Miriam Al-Adib, a gynaecologist and the mother of one of the girls affected.
I said to the girls affected that they should not be afraid or feel ashamed or feel responsible because they had done nothing wrong. I also recorded a message for the boys in which I said, "Perhaps you don't realize, but this is very serious and it has very serious consequences. These are normal kids, they are not criminals. But if you give a normal kid a gun to play with, he might end up committing a crime. And if you give him a toy to play with, like artificial intelligence, he might end up committing a serious crime."
It's still not clear what charges, if any, the boys believed to be responsible could face, particularly given their ages. But while this case has shaken this small town in a corner of Spain, it's clear that with AI technology so readily available, this could have happened almost anywhere.
Guy Hedgeco reporting. When one of Britain's worst serial killers was arrested in January 1981, it finally put an end to the biggest manhunt the UK had ever seen. Peter Sutcliffe, otherwise known as the Yorkshire Ripper, murdered at least 13 women and tried to kill others, stabbing them and brutalising their bodies. Countless books and TV programmes have been devoted to the subject. More recently, attempts have been made to look at the story from the perspective of the women and why the police didn't pay more attention to the testimonies of survivors. A new programme is being released in the UK called The Long Shadow. Rebecca Kesby spoke to Joan Smith, a journalist who covered the story. But first we'll hear from Mo Lear, who was attacked by Peter Sutcliffe in October 1980. How does she feel about the new programme?
It doesn't catapult me back in time as it used to, because I've kind of become accustomed to talking about this into the press.
I mean, is there a sense that as a survivor you feel maybe some responsibility to talk because you can, and there are those women that obviously can't?
Absolutely. As a survivor, I do feel a responsibility for all of the other women involved. And my responsibility is to try and get justice, to see if we can somehow rectify the legacy of the sheer stupidity of the press and the police in particular.
Well, let's bring Joan Smith in, because it took years to catch Peter Sutcliffe. There were so many clues pointing to him. He was interviewed by police 9 times in the course of their inquiries and never arrested and carried on killing people. And it's been one of the biggest scandals, if you like, of this. Why do you think the police didn't catch him sooner?
They didn't listen to women. What the police did was, because the first murders took place in a red light area, they wrongly assumed that the first victim was a prostitute. They told the world that this was a man who hated prostitutes, and they missed absolutely crucial eyewitness evidence.
One of the other major criticisms was that the police got sidetracked by what turned out to be a hoax. Another man who wanted his moment of fame claimed responsibility and sent the police some audio tapes and letters as well, claiming to be this Ripper character. And it sent the police off in the wrong direction, partly because of his very distinctive accent. We've got a little clip of it just here now.
You are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started.
So a lot of money and effort went into chasing this character, and it wasn't him.
It was an obvious hoax. I was at a press conference in Manchester. There was a big build-up to it. You know, we're inviting you to a press conference where you will hear the voice of the Yorkshire Ripper. It was very like that. Then they played the tape, and I said, there is nothing on that tape that isn't in the public domain. I really thought it was a hoax. But of course, they didn't listen because they never listened to women. Now, they'd been told by several of the surviving victims that he was local, but they knew better. And several women died and were attacked directly as a result of them falling for that hoax.
Mo, you were a young student at the time in Leeds, yeah, which is the scene of many of the killings. And can you describe how women felt at that fear?
It was palpable. The art studios were empty. Women didn't go out during the evening. There were billboards all over the town. These ridiculous recordings of this hoaxer were played on the bus. It was nuts.
He did target you, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. A group of us would go out to a pub in Headingley, and my friends, after we left, I think it was about 10 past 10, said, do you want us to walk you into town to catch the bus? And I'm like, no, it's fine, don't be silly. And I carried on walking home alone, and I thought I'd take a shortcut. And as I walked down this road, this young man, I could hear a voice to my right. He was on the other side of the street. I turned round and he started walking towards me. I didn't recognise him, even though it was dark. I could see his eyes and I could see his hair. I made my excuses out. Now, I'm sorry, I've got to catch my bus. And I carried on walking down the street and I could hear his footsteps behind me. So I started to run. And as I ran, I heard his footsteps getting quicker and quicker. And then I felt this massive blow to the top of my head. And that was it. I blacked out. I survived because of the intervention of a passerby who apparently heard me let out a scream as I fell, but I don't remember doing that.
And he wasn't even caught by the detectives who were searching for him. He was actually caught by South Yorkshire police. And it was just that a sort of, you know, sharp-eyed traffic cop saw that he had rather crudely attached fake number plates to his car. And they stopped him, and he was sitting there with a young woman who he claimed was his girlfriend. But of course, he'd just picked up another potential victim. And by then, 13 women were dead, definitely. 9 had been attacked and injured very, very seriously. You know, there's an instinct now to say, well, it's all different now. And I don't think that it is, because in London, where we have the largest police force in the UK, the Metropolitan Police, nearly 500 police officers are actually under investigation for domestic or sexual violence themselves. Police forces were riddled with misogyny in the 1970s. They are now. And misogyny affects the way they carry out investigations. But for me, as a young journalist, what I realise is that women are on our own. We can't trust the police. And I feel very strongly that that's still the case.
And the new programme is called The Long Shadow. Still to come, the Ethiopian athlete who smashed 2 minutes off the women's marathon world record.
This victory shows that hard training and good preparation prove their worth. And for Ethiopia as a country, it will probably be a big boost for both men and women for the Olympics.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Money laundering operations.
A cyber criminal group.
These are smart guys.
Seasons 1 and 2 of The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service are available in full right now.
Following the twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service. Catch up with the whole series now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Ukraine and Russia will face each other for a second week of hearings at the UN's highest court on Monday. Kyiv brought the case to the International Court of Justice, arguing that Moscow had used false claims of genocide to justify the 2022 invasion. But these hearings are focusing on Russia's claims that the ICJ doesn't have jurisdiction, a legal mandate to rule on the case at all. Anna Holligan has been following the hearings in The Hague.
Kyiv is arguing Moscow violated the 1948 Genocide Convention when President Putin claimed the Russian invasion was an effort to stop Kyiv from committing genocide. Kyiv, which argues this justification for the war is illegal under international law, wants the ICJ to order Russia to stop hostilities and pay reparations. Russia claims the use of force between states is regulated by a different charter, and if there is no genocide in Ukraine, then a complaint filed under the Genocide Convention should be thrown out. Today, Russia's lawyers have all day to make their final arguments. Last week, every single European Union member state, with the exception of Hungary, plus Australia, Canada and the UK, took part in a full day of hearings, all speaking in support of Ukraine's legal stance.
Indigenous communities around the world have often seen their land taken and their people exploited. Now, many countries provide legal protection and organisations support them. Two sisters and their mother have been charged with fraud in Canada after allegedly pretending to be Inuit in order to receive benefits from Indigenous organisations. Here's Terry Egan.
Members of Canada's Inuit community, who live in the sparsely populated Northern Territory, are able to receive benefits such as grants and scholarships. That's part of an Indigenous land claim settlement going back to 1993. In March, though, an organisation that represents Inuit interests in the territory said it had become aware of possible fraudulent enrolment. They named two sisters, Amira and Nadia Gill, and their mother, Karima Manji. Miss Manji is reported to have said the children were adopted and Inuit by birth. Because of that, the three were entitled to money provided by two local groups, as well as various other benefits. But the woman, named as the birth mother, said she was not related to the sisters, and after an investigation, the three women were removed from a list of beneficiaries. The matter was also referred to the police. Some Canadians have referred to those falsely claiming Indigenous ancestry as pretendians. One community member said the term, though, downplays the severity of the issue because it sounds harmless. She said she preferred to call it fraud. Now the women are due to appear in court. It's not yet clear how they'll plead.
Next to Berlin. This is the moment that Ethiopia's Tigist Assefa smashed the women's world record for the marathon, taking more than 2 minutes off the previous record. The details from Alex Capstick.
As one of the fastest marathon courses on the planet, it's no surprise a world record has been broken. But even by Berlin standards, this was an astonishing run by Ethiopia's Tigist Assefa. The defending champion, who only began competing in the marathon in April last year, maintained a blistering pace from start to finish. She won in a remarkable 2 hours, 11 minutes and 53 seconds, obliterating the previous best by over 2 minutes. It overshadowed another dominant performance from Eliud Kipchoge in the men's event. The 38-year-old Kenyan chalked up an unprecedented fifth title on Berlin's flat inner-city route, although he wasn't able to challenge the record time he set in the race 12 months ago.
And this is what Tigist Assefa had to say after her win.
In the first part, I ran in a way that made sure I wasn't exhausted for the second part, which is why the first was a bit slower than the second. This victory shows that hard training and good preparation prove their worth. And for Ethiopia as a country, it will probably be a big boost for both men and women for the Olympics.
Now, if you recognise this theme tune, you'll know which story from the past few days we're talking about next. This is the music from HBO's global hit Succession, about a vastly wealthy and elderly media tycoon trying to decide which of his children should inherit his media empire. People have drawn parallels between its main character, Logan Roy, and the real-life media tycoon Rupert Murdoch, who stepped down in recent days, aged 92, handing over his succession to his son Lachlan. The man who plays Logan Roy is the Hollywood star Brian Cox.
Well, I think he's been watching too much Succession. You know, you can't predict these things, but the fact that he chose one son over the other, you know, it's quite funny, really. There comes a time, you know, I've just lost my sister. She was 92. I think he's doing pretty well. I mean, we've no idea what his mental health is like. I suspect it is pretty good, but I think the workload must be just too much now. I mean, not surprised, actually, because he is probably the most tenacious human on God's earth, but he's just kept on going. But I think eventually there comes a point when he has to stop, and it had to happen, and it's happened.
I mean, it's interesting in his statement, he's nailing his legacy of his family and his business in one or two sentences. My father firmly believed in freedom, and Lachlan is absolutely committed to the cause.
Well, that's a kind of generalisation statement, isn't it? Freedom for what? Freedom to impose his ideas on other people, freedom to kind of manipulate certain things in certain directions. I mean, he's certainly done a lot of that in his life. It's so weird, you know, when you play somebody and people keep saying, oh, well, of course, it's Rupert Murdoch. And you go, no, it isn't. It's Logan Roy. He's a very different animal, really, from Rupert. You know, the one big difference is that Rupert inherited Logan. Mm. He didn't have anything to inherit. He started from ground zero.
And, of course, the big similarity is that Logan Roy and Rupert Murdoch, one in real life, one on your TV creation, had children whom they basically either pitted against each other or had to choose the talents of to run the business. That's the big similarity.
Yeah. Well, that's where it falls into the sort of succession mode. So I think there's a sort of, I think James was backing off in many, many ways. So the heir position was pretty vacant for Lachlan to kind of move into it. So I suspect that there are some family fissures there, which we will hear about in due time, but not at the moment.
You joked at the beginning, you know, that Rupert Murdoch had been watching too much Succession. In fact, we do know that a member of the family did find you in a coffee shop.
Oh, yeah, that's happened to me, yeah. Because it was his son-in-law, very nice man. I was just sort of waiting for my coffee, and this voice was behind me, and said, well, you know, it's very interesting. And I thought, what the hell is going on? What's he talking about? And he said, yeah, it's an interesting series. I think my wife finds it not easy at times, but on the whole, she's good about it. And I said, I'm sorry. He said, what is it you're talking about? He said, oh, well, my wife is Elizabeth Murdoch. And I went, oh, I see. And he was a very, very nice man. And at the end of the conversation, he sort of gave it away a bit by saying, do you think that maybe the writers could be a bit nicer to him next season?
Just reading your biography, I know that in 1990, you were Lear in Deborah Warner's production. You began as a Shakespearean actor. And our listeners would love to know what it says about us, the Lear story, the choice between daughters, the Roy story, the choice between children, the Murdoch story that... There's something in us. We want to know how blood and treasure divide. We want to see the anger, the jealousy, the pain.
From the word go, when the show was pitched to me by Jesse Armstrong and Adam McKay, and I knew the series was going to work because the public loved those series of Dynasty, Dallas.
Yeah.
So they're obsessed by families. Because everybody has a family, so naturally it reflects on your family or the lack of success in your family or the opposite of your family, the success of your family. And I think that's what the audiences enjoy. They want it and they want more.
The actor Brian Cox with Paddy O'Connell. For years, Thailand's elephant handlers, known as mahouts, have put their elephants to work performing in tourist hotspots, despite concerns from animal rights campaigners. COVID restrictions meant that work dried up, and hundreds of elephants were taken to a remote part of Thailand to see out lockdowns. 3 years on, some mahouts and their elephants are now making that move permanent. Lucy Hedges has been to meet some of them.
I've come to the Thai province of Surin. It's a beautiful and remote area 300 miles from the capital, Bangkok, and known as the spiritual home of the mahouts, or elephant handlers.
Kap, sawadee kap.
Hi, Sayab.
Kap.
I'm here to meet Sayab, who used to work in the northern city of Chiang Mai, charging tourists for elephant rides. His companion, Ekiset,
munches grass beside us. And how old is he?
38. 38.
Is that quite old in elephant years?
He's not old. Elephant years are like human years. So he is in middle age. We've been together for 23 years. When we apart, I miss him and feel lonely.
During the COVID lockdown when tourism shut down, hundreds of mahouts brought their elephants back to Surin, where government institutions offered them a salary and free veterinary care. Many mahouts, like Sayab, decided to stay.
I got a place to live. I got a land to cut the grass. I got grass seeds, plant, and I've got a salary. The elephant is close to the elephant's hospital, and I have welfare.
An estimated 3,000 elephants are used across the country to entertain tourists, from animal rides to painting pictures with their trunks or even riding bicycles. Animal rights charities say they are routinely mistreated. The Thai government says it plans to strengthen laws governing their welfare. Elephants like Ekiset are now a world away from the busy tourist hotspots, though I notice he is still chained to the floor. Sayab says it's for his safety due to his large size.
You know, he's in the same place for a long time. Is he a happy elephant?
He's an extremely happy elephant, definitely. He loves a simple life, and now we live simply, eating, going for a walk. Now his life is easy.
It's more than 3 years since the first COVID lockdowns, and Sayab says he has no intention of putting Ekiset back to work. He plans to continue living on land provided for him by an institution called the Elephant Kingdom, which tourists can visit, though there'll be no rides or circus tricks. Since Thailand reopened for tourism, many mahouts have returned to their old places of work, taking their elephants with them. But increased awareness of their welfare has meant some of the old attractions have either disappeared or are making new ethical promises. Campaigners, though, say the only truly responsible way to see these magnificent beasts is at a distance in the wild.
Lucy Hedges reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, do drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you'll find us on X, formerly Twitter, where we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.